Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive.
Hello.
Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into, well, a truly extraordinary career and, honestly, a pretty complex inner life. A comic legend.
Hmm.
His material was often called anarchic, deeply dark, sometimes maybe inappropriate.
Sometimes definitely inappropriate.
Right? But always, undeniably, just possessing this genius only he could conjure up. We are, of course, talking about Norman Jean McDonald.
And when we talk about Norm Macdonald, look, we aren't just summarizing some great comedian. It's more than that. We're trying to unpack the methodology of a true original.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a man whom David Letterman himself, you know, a pioneer of late night, he flat out declared Norm the best stand-up comedian.
That's huge praise.
It is. And that high praise isn't just like hyperbole. It's really an acknowledgement that Norm operated on a completely different plane of comedic thought. It's just different.
So our mission in this deep dive is to synthesize the sources covering his, 36-year career. It stretches from his start way back in 1985 right up to his passing in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to focus intensely on his unique, unrepeatable comedic identity. That signature deadpan style, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
The career-defining controversies. And we have to get into the legendary OJ saga.
Absolutely. It's central.
And also the deeply private secrets he kept hidden from basically everyone until his final days.
Right. And to really get Norm Macdonald, you have to understand the fabric of his humor first. It is defined by that deadpan delivery, sure.
The ultimate deadpan, maybe.
Maybe. But it's not just the absence of emotion. It feels more like a philosophical commitment to the bit itself, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's built on this eccentric understatement, these folksy, almost old-fashioned phrases that kind of mask the intellectual cruelty sometimes lurking in the joke.
Oh, definitely. And the non sequiturs.
The non sequiturs. And, of course, his use of black comedy and those incredible sprawling shaggy dog stories.
You know, the genius of the deadpan, I think, is that it serves as a barrier almost.
How so?
Well, the audience doesn't get that instant gratification,
yeah.
You know, the comedian reacting along with them. Instead, the lack of reaction forces you, the listener, to do the intellectual heavy lifting.
Exactly. It's like comedy as a performance art of patience.
Yeah.
And internal logic.
Right.
And that patience, it's tied directly to his early academic interests, I think. If you look at his background, he studied mathematics and philosophy.
Which seems counterintuitive for a comedian, maybe.
Maybe on the surface, but it isn't accidental, I don't think. His comedy often relied on this rigorous but totally absurd internal logic. Like a mathematical proof or some philosophical treatise where the conclusion, however ridiculous it is,
it follows naturally from the nonsensical premises he just laid out.
Precisely. He wasn't aiming for the universal quick laugh all the time. He was aiming for that specific, really rewarding aha moment.
The one you earned by following the thread.
Yeah, earned by those who followed that logical thread right into absurdity with him.
Okay, so let's unpack where this fascinating, complex voice even originated. We have to start back in Quebec City, Quebec. Norm Macdonald, born there October 17th, 1959.
Right. And both of his parents were Anglophone teachers, English speakers, which immediately put him in a kind of minority cultural position within his largely French-speaking hometown.
That context, the Anglophone thing in Quebec City, it feels pretty crucial.
Oh, it is. Our sources highlight that his father actually prevented him from learning French. He insisted the family speak only English at home.
Wow. So that deliberate isolation.
Yeah, it kind of set him up from an early age as a slight outsider, didn't it? Cultivating that detached observational perspective that really defined his comedy later on. He was always watching the world from a slight remove.
In his academic history, it certainly didn't scream future performer. He went to Quebec High School, but later claimed he dropped out of Gloucester High School at 16.
But the truth apparently is that he graduated remarkably early, just 14 years old.
14? Seriously?
Yeah.
That age discrepancy is just classic Norm, though, isn't it? Blurring biographical facts, maybe for comedic effect, maybe just cuz.
Probably.
Regardless, that early graduation, it does highlight this profound restlessness, I think, and intellectual energy. He entered Carleton University at 16, pursuing mathematics and philosophy.
Only to drop out.
Right. Then he briefly tried journalism and broadcasting television at Algonquin College. He was actually following his older brother, Neil Macdonald, who became a pretty prominent journalist. But these were all just temporary stops.
And before the bright lights, you know, New York, L.A.,
yeah,
he was doing manual labor, stuff that seems totally disconnected from the cerebral comic we remember. Like, he worked as a choker man for a logging company.
It's a jarring image, isn't it? The deadpan master wrangling logs. But maybe it's actually key to his grounded persona.
How do you mean?
Well, that mix of rigorous intellectual curiosity, the philosophy, the math, combined with hard physical labor, it might have given him that distinct, folksy, grounded tone.
A tone that often provided this deceptive, kind of calming counterpoint.
To the truly brutal black comedy hidden inside the jokes. Exactly.
So his actual jump into stand-up started in Ottawa in 1985, Yik Yik's Amateur Nights.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a surprising fact about this future legend. His very first performance apparently went okay, but he was so overwhelmed by the intensity, he bolted, ran out of the club, swore he'd never do it again.
Wow. It really speaks volumes about the anxiety that can often underlie, you know, profound talent.
Totally.
The club owner, Howard Wagman, actually had to track him down and persuade him, really convince him to come back.
But once he committed,
the trajectory was immediate. By 1986, after performing at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, he was already being called one of this country's hottest comics.
Pretty fast rise.
Very fast. And this quick success led to some crucial U.S. exposure pretty early on. His network TV debut was, believe it or not, The Pat Sajak Show in 1989.
The Pat Sajak Show.
Yeah. But the real launch pad, the one that mattered, was Late Night with David Letterman in May 1990.
Ah, the Letterman connection. That makes sense.
That appearance was just foundational. Letterman immediately recognized a kindred spirit in Norm's dry, almost anti-comedy approach.
Right.
Letterman became this fierce advocate. He said later if they could have had him on every single week, they would have. That stamp of approval was just crucial for his next steps in the U.S. comedy world.
And those next steps were some quick writing gigs. Oh. He wrote for the short run of The Dennis Miller Show in 92.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got a writing position on Roseanne during the 92-93 season. A job he famously quit.
To join the cast of Saturday Night Live, yeah.
But before we jump fully into SNL, let's pause for a sec on his view of Canadian versus U.S. comedy. Because he had a pretty strong take on it.
He really did. Norm's perspective was basically that Canadian stand-ups were, generally speaking, superior.
Yeah.
Better comics.
Why? What was his reasoning?
Because they viewed stand-up as an end in itself. It was their entire lives, you know, focused purely on the craft of stand-up.
Right, whereas he believed U.S. stand-ups often sought merely as a springboard,
mm-hmm.
just a way to get to film or TV.
Exactly. And that distinction, it reveals his deep reverence for the craft itself. For him, stand-up comedy was the highest aspiration, not just some stepping stone.
That purity of intention, maybe that's what informed everything he did on SNL.
I think so. And that leads us perfectly into part two. The whole SNL weekend update saga, a period that really defined his public image, running roughly from 93 to 98.
He joined SNL in 1993. He was pulling double duty, right? Writer and cast member for five seasons total.
Mm-hmm.
And while he had some memorable impressions, his Bob Dole, remember that, during the 96 election,
okay.
just disheveled, defeated, brilliant.
Yeah, the Dole is fantastic.
But he is truly iconic for his time anchoring weekend update. He held that chair from 1994 onwards. For about 3.5 seasons.
And his update was, well, it was chaotic, it was challenging, often baffling, frankly, to mainstream viewers.
Which is exactly why his diehard fans love it so much.
Precisely. He introduced these signature eccentric elements that just defined his time there. We're talking about running jokes that were deeply inappropriate, often involving things like prison rape and crack whores.
He really dared the audience to be uncomfortable.
He did. And his commitment to the non sequitur was just unparalleled. He'd often finish delivering some piece of really shocking news only to suddenly pull out a compact tape recorder.
Oh, the tape recorder.
Rewind it and deliver a personal, often totally mundane note to self.
That little bit of stage business, it just encapsulated the whole absurd commitment to the anti-joke, didn't it?
It really did. But if we're defining the update era, we absolutely have to talk about the king of his non sequiturs, Frank Stallone.
Oh my God, Frank Stallone. He constantly blamed Frank Stallone, Stallone's often forgotten brother, for literally every societal ill. High unemployment. Frank Stallone. Toxic waste gums. Frank Stallone.
Let's just take a second on the mechanics of that joke, because it's pure, beautiful non sequitur. A non sequitur, literally, it does not follow, right? It's a conclusion or a statement that just doesn't logically connect to what came before. The joke's success relies entirely on the unexpected absurdity of dragging in some totally unconnected person.
And Frank Stallone was the perfect target for that randomness.
He really was. Norm would read a story about, say, a budget crisis in Congress, and then, without missing a beat, just deadpan. Or so the Germans would have us believe. Oh, wait, no, that was a different running gag. He'd blame Frank Stallone.
Right, right, the Frank Stallone one. It was entirely random. And what's amazing is that Frank Stallone himself, according to the sources, took zero offense.
Yeah, he got it. He recognized Norm wasn't actually attacking him, but just using his name as the ultimate punchline for randomness itself.
When did he stop?
Norm only stopped the joke in 1997, and apparently only because Sylvester Stallone, when he was guest hosting SNL, personally asked him to. Politely, but still.
Okay, so here's where the conversation always turns, right? The controversial jokes and the inevitable pushback that really marked his time there. Norm was absolutely fearless in embracing black comedy, even when targeting really sensitive or high-profile people.
Yeah, the relentless jokes about Michael Jackson are a really clear flashpoint. After Jackson's divorce from Lisa Marie Presley, Norm consistently referred to him on air as a homosexual pedophile.
Just brutal.
And when Jackson was hospitalized, Norm remarked that he had decorated his room with Shirley Temple photographs. Then he delivered the follow-up punchline. But don't get any ideas. Michael Jackson is a homosexual pedophile.
Just driving it home.
He knew exactly how far he could push it, didn't he? There was another moment, too, that drew really sharp criticism.
No.
1996, after John Lauder was sentenced for the murder of Brandon, Tina, and others.
Right. Norm made this incredibly dark joke suggesting that basically everyone involved in that horrific story should die.
Yeah.
Just a blanket statement.
And the reaction. That specific comment led to immediate backlash from activist groups like the Transsexual Menace. They actually threatened to picket SNL.
Wow.
So NBC felt compelled to review the broadcast, and they agreed the line was inappropriate. They promised preventative measures. It just demonstrates that constant tension he fostered, pushing the boundary until the network institution itself had to pull him back.
But the ultimate, the career-defining controversy, the one that became this media narrative that honestly overshadows almost everything else,
yeah,
that was his firing as the Weekend Update anchor in early 1998.
Mm-hmm. Officially, the story was NBC West Coast president Don Olmeyer cited declining ratings and a drop-off in quality. Colin Quinn replaced him. That was the line.
That was the official line.
Right. But Norm and his supporters, including his longtime writer Jim Downey, who got fired at the exact same time they insisted the true reason was his unrelenting, highly personal mockery of O.J. Simpson during and after the murder trial.
He was just hammering O.J. constantly, uncompromisingly calling him a murderer on network television week after week.
And this is where the personal really bleeds into the professional, right? Olmeyer wasn't just some network exec. He was a close friend and a vocal supporter of O.J. Simpson.
So this wasn't just about comedy styles clashing.
No way. It was basically an ideological and personal war being waged right there from the news desk. Downey even publicly pointed out that Olmeyer threw a party for the jurors who acquitted Simpson. That's how close they were.
The firing just blew up. It was a massive public media thing. And Norm refused to let it go quietly.
Not at all. He immediately went on Letterman. He went on the Howard Stern Show. He essentially used competing networks to air all the dirty laundry and continue the attack on Olmeyer.
Which just cemented his persona, right? The comedian willing to torch his own career for a point of integrity, or at least for the joke.
Exactly. And Olmeyer's retaliation was intense. It went beyond just the firing. In June 98, Olmeyer actually blocked NBC from airing advertisements for Norm's new movie, Dirty Work.
Seriously?
Yeah. He accused Norm of disparaging NBC on those competitor shows, on Letterman and Stern. The ad ban during SNL itself was only lifted after Robert Wright, who was Olmeyer's boss, stepped in.
Wow. So the war got really nasty.
It did. Norm went to the Daily News and called Olmeyer a liar and a thug. But he was careful to emphasize that his issue was solely with Olmeyer, who he saw as trying to censor him, not with Lorne Michaels or SNL itself, who he always maintained were supportive of him.
But here's the interesting thing connecting this to the bigger picture.
Hmm.
Years later, Norm offered this really fascinating kind of nuanced reflection. It complicated that simple, it was all OJ narrative.
Right. He eventually conceded that maybe his removal was less about OJ specifically and more about just long-term insubordination, being difficult.
That's a crucial admission, isn't it?
It is. He acknowledged he often resisted marching orders. He recalled a time when he ignored Lorne Michaels' concern about a potential Michael Jackson lawsuit. Lorne was worried. Norm did the joke anyway. And he admitted his update was explicitly not designed to be audience-pleasing or warm. He prioritized the unique integrity of his own comedic voice way above network demands.
So the OJ stuff might have just been the final straw, not the sole reason.
That seems plausible. It pushed things over the edge after a pattern of maybe pushing back too hard.
Which brings us to one final defiant flourish from that whole SNL era. When he came back to host SNL on October 23, 1999, his opening monologue was just pure norm.
What did he say?
He joked that the only reason they asked him back was because the show has gotten really bad since he left. Just displaying that sustained resentment, that anti-establishment stance right there on their stage.
Ah, that's amazing. A full circle moment using the very platform that tried to silence him to critique its current state. That defiance really became the foundation for his post-SNL creative work.
And that output started immediately with what some people call the revenge comedy, his movie.
Dirty Work. Yeah, 1998. He co-wrote it and starred in it. Directed by Bob Saget, co-starring Artie Lange. And it featured Chris Farley in his last film role before he died.
Yeah, that's right.
And Dirty Work really embodied that revenge spirit, didn't it? It was chaotic, often pretty lowbrow. It felt like a direct counterstatement to the polished focus group stuff NBC might have preferred him to do.
And the film was dedicated to Farley's memory, which added this poignant, almost anarchic tribute quality to the whole thing.
Definitely. After the film, he did try to fit into the more conventional structure of network TV. He headlined the Norm Show later. They just called it Norm. That ran for 3 seasons on ABC, from 99 to 2001.
Which is a respectable run, actually. Yeah. Especially for a comedian who had just been publicly branded this insubordinate outsider.
It is. But then he tried another sitcom later, A Minute with Stan Hooper, on Fox in 2003. And this is where we really see the limits of trying to fit his style into the mainstream sitcom box.
How long did that last?
Canceled after only 6 episodes.
Ouch. Why do you think that failed so quickly when the other one had a decent run?
Well, if you look at the format, right? Network sitcoms rely on predictable character beats, escalating situational humor, laughs per minute, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Norm's comedy, especially his delivery, is kind of antithetical to that.
Yeah.
He specializes in deflating situations, not building them up. His pace is slow, his characterizations are eccentric, and his humor actively resists that necessary warmth or relatability you need for mass audience appeal on a Friday night, you know?
Right. His genius just didn't translate into the required predictability of that format.
Exactly. So that failure kind of pushed him into other creative avenues. And this is where his surprising versatility as a voice actor really became apparent.
Yeah, like Lucky the Dog in the Dr. Dolittle movies.
Right. Multiple Dr. Dolittle films starting in 98, which introduced his voice to this entirely new family-friendly audience, which is kind of hilarious in itself.
It really is.
And for fans of more adult animation, his voice work is iconic. He was Pigeon on Mike Tyson Mysteries.
Oh, Pigeon was amazing.
69 episodes from 2014 to 2020. Pigeon, the wisecracking, super cynical sidekick. It was basically Norm's persona just transferred directly onto a cartoon bird.
Totally. He also had other roles, like Jeannie Norm on The Fairly Odd Parents. And interestingly, he was the original voice of Death on Family Guy way back in 2000.
Before Norm Crosby took over, yeah. What's fascinating, though, is that his final performance was also a voice role, one he completed posthumously. Yefit, the gelatinous engineer on the Orville.
Ah, right.
It's a remarkable range when you think about it, stretching from family movies to really adult comedy to genre sci-fi. It shows this adaptability that may be contrasted with his rigid stand-up persona.
He also slipped into live-action cameos here and there. He played Michael Richards uncredited in the Andy Kaufman biopic Man on the Moon in 99.
Right, right. Then the 2010s saw his career shift again. He found this perfect home, really, in the sort of nascent digital media landscape, which suited his deliberate pace and his discursive style much better than network TV did.
Like the sports show with Norm Macdonald on Comedy Central in 2011.
Yeah, which was basically a satirical sports version of The Daily Show. Fun idea.
But the real sweet spot, the format that seemed to give him maximum freedom, was his talk show concept, starting with Norm Macdonald Live.
Yes, yeah. 2013 to 2017. That video podcast with his sidekick, Adam Egget, filmed on this notoriously low-budget set. It was definitely rough around the edges, but it got overwhelmingly positive reviews. People loved the chaotic, unpredictable energy and the depth of the conversation.
It was the complete opposite of the polished, pre-scripted late-night interview, wasn't it?
Totally. He'd engage guests in these meandering, often really awkward, but surprisingly profound conversations that just felt utterly genuine. You never knew where it was going.
And that platform eventually evolved into the Netflix series, Norm Macdonald Has a Show, in 2018. still maintained that low-budget, unpredictable vibe.
He also ventured into literature with Based on a True Story in 2016, and he deliberately marketed it as a comic novel, not a memoir, because he knew he was going to fill it with elaborate falsehoods and totally fictionalized accounts. It was another layer of performance. And it was a huge success. Debuted on the New York Times bestsellers list, it underscored the fan demand for access to his interior life, even he delivered it wrapped entirely in fiction.
Before we move into the personal contradictions, yeah, we really have to talk about his last stand-up appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman, May 15, 2015. It was Letterman's farewell run.
Oh, that was such a moment.
Norm's performance provided this glimpse of pure, unmasked emotion you so rarely saw from him.
The vulnerability was just stunning. He was doing a classic Norm Shaggy Dog story, but then halfway through, he just stopped. He broke into tears. And he told Letterman, who he first saw perform when Norm himself was only 13, that he truly loved him.
Wow.
That profound honesty right there, contrasted with the mask of his deadpan, it just resonated so deeply. Revealed the deep affection and respect he held for his mentors and for the tradition of comedy itself.
And it's that vulnerability, maybe, that leads us squarely into part four, the personal contradictions and views that reveal the deep thinker beneath the jokester persona.
Yeah, we've established his comedic influences, right? Bob Newhart, Sam Kinison, Rodney Dangerfield. But when you couple those with his literary influences, Leo Tolstoy and Anton Chekhov.
Tolstoy and Chekhov.
Seriously.
Seriously. And suddenly you see the blueprint for his long-form patient storytelling. He was using the narrative structure of a great 19th century author, where the journey and all the digressions are actually more important than the final payoff or punchline.
That's the link to the Shaggy Dog story, isn't it? Tolstoy and Chekhov are masters of that slow, deliberate build-up of context and detail.
Absolutely. A Shaggy Dog story requires the listener to invest in the sheer commitment of the narrator, just like a novel does. The reward isn't some quick joke. The reward is the sheer absurdity of the journey itself, often ending with a non-punchline or an anticlimax. That's the point.
The intellectual depth was always there, under the surface.
Always.
And it also informed his views on the state of modern comedy. He expressed real distaste for what he called the low-hanging fruit of constant topical jokes. He specifically cited all the Donald Trump jokes.
What did he prefer?
Humor that aimed for something more universal, more enduringly absurd, rather than just temporary political relevance.
Okay, moving into his personal battles. One of the most critical revelations, especially later on, was his severe, sustained battle with gambling addiction.
Yeah, this was serious. He revealed he lost all his money gambling not once, but three separate times, drove him to bankruptcy twice.
The scale of the loss is just staggering. It underlines how severe the crisis was for him. He cited his largest single loss as a devastating $400,000.
Wow. This wasn't some casual vice. It was a recurring financial catastrophe that deeply impacted his life, his career, everything.
And what's fascinating is how that vice apparently ended, or at least lessened. He claimed the 2006 shutdown of U.S. online poker kind of saved my life. Because prior to that, he said he was constantly playing up to 20 limit hold'em games simultaneously online, just grinding himself into the ground with the intensity of it.
20 games at once. Wow. Despite the addiction, though, he also managed some modest professional success in the poker world. It shows how deeply engaged he was with the game.
Like actual tournament success.
Yeah, he cashed for over $20,000 in a tournament in 2006 and made nearly $15,000 in the 2007 World Series of Poker. It highlights that competitive, mathematical side of his mind again, the side drawn to the calculated risks of the game.
Okay, now we have to address maybe the biggest contradiction of his public persona. His devout Christianity.
Right. This deadpan comedian, specializing in the profane, the anarchic, was also a Christian who publicly discussed theology. His views were often compared to the 19th century philosopher Søren Kierkegaard.
Kierkegaard. Why him specifically?
Well, Kierkegaard's philosophy often emphasizes things like the leap of faith, subjective truth, embracing the absurdity of existence. It kind of fits, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, actually.
Norm's comedy embraced the profane and the absurd elements of life, yet his faith was apparently quite sincere. He seemed to understand that these seeming contradictions, high religious faith coexisting with low, dark comedy, are just fundamentally human, that we contain multitudes.
And this inherent moral, or maybe intellectual compass, sometimes showed up in his professional life, too, like when he was judging Last Comic Standing.
Oh, yeah. He criticized a contestant for a joke referencing the Bible in Harry Potter.
Was he offended by the religious aspect?
Not exactly. He wasn't condemning the subject matter itself. He was condemning what he saw as a lack of intellectual rigor. He basically said, if you're going to critique an entire religion, you must at least know what you're talking about. Don't just make cheap shots.
Interesting. That combination, though, loyalty to friends, belief in free speech, but also this moral conviction, sometimes landed him in immediate professional trouble, most famously during the hashtag MeToo controversy in 2018.
Right. After he made some public comments that appeared to criticize aspects of the movement and seemed to defend friends like Louis C.K. and Roseanne Barr, the consequences were immediate.
What happened?
His scheduled appearance on The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon was abruptly canceled, just pulled. The network, the show, they saw the risk, and the consequence was swift and very public.
It really highlighted his almost like anarchic tendency to prioritize loyalty and absolute freedom of expression, even when it flew directly into a major cultural firestorm.
Yeah, he seemed willing to accept the professional fallout from his refusal to just conform to the prevailing cultural winds of that moment.
And talk about confusing signals. In 2019, on David Spade's show Lights Out, Norm completely threw fans for a loop. He claimed he might have rushed to judgment about O.J. Simpson's guilt.
Wait, seriously, after all that?
Yeah. Was it genuine reflection? Was it some kind of meta joke about his own reputation? Or just a way to finally move on? Who knows?
It's classic Norm ambiguity, isn't it? His friend and producing partner, Lori Jo Hoekstra, even claimed O.J. Simpson reached out to thank him after that comment and offered to play golf with him.
Get out. Did they?
Doesn't seem like it. Still. However, it's worth noting, when O.J. died in 2024, Conan O'Brien explicitly paid tribute to Norm, confirming that the original uncompromising O.J. commentary on SNL was, in fact, brilliant comedy. That's the stance that cemented his legend, regardless of any later rhetorical games he played.
Okay, now we arrive at the final, and maybe the deepest secret of his life. A secret that makes his creative output during those last 8 years, especially in the 2010s, seem even more astonishing and, frankly, courageous.
Yeah. McDonald battled cancer privately for 8 long years. It started with a diagnosis of multiple myeloma back in 2013.
And he told almost no one.
He made a deliberate decision to disclose his condition only to his immediate family and his agent. That's it. His brother, Neil, confirmed the secrecy was driven by a deep fear. He feared revealing the illness would affect the way he was perceived. He didn't want to be seen as sick or vulnerable. He wanted to be seen as Norm.
Imagine the dedication required to maintain that public persona while undergoing intense medical treatments.
It's incredible. He underwent several stem cell transplants, apparently using aliases to maintain his privacy. His final transplant was in March 2021. And the chemotherapy had debilitating side effects, like peripheral neuropathy, which forced him to give up golf and tennis, two things he really loved.
So the medical journey was just grueling.
Extremely. The multiple myeloma did initially go into remission, which was good news. But then, tragically, in early 2020, he developed treatment-associated myelodysplastic syndrome. It's a type of cancer often associated with prior chemotherapy.
And that progresses.
It often progresses into acute myeloid leukemia, which it did.
He succumbed to complications from acute leukemia on September 14, 2021. He was 61 years old. But his commitment to his craft and his absolute control over his public image, it endured right until the very last moment.
That control really manifested in the extraordinary posthumous release of Norm Macdonald, Nothing Special, in 2022.
That was the stand-up set he recorded at home.
Exactly. Knowing his condition was worsening, he had taped an audience-less dry run of a brand new stand-up set, just in his own home, just in case things went south, as he apparently put it, a truly prescient act of preserving his material himself.
And that special was met with just enormous critical acclaim, earned him 3 Primetime Emmy nominations posthumously.
Yeah, and it was followed by this really moving discussion among his peers, Chappelle, Letterman, O'Brien, Sandler, Molly Shannon, David Spade, all just talking about the genius that had commanded their respect for decades.
His final performance, as you mentioned, that voice role as Yafit on The Orville, season 3, it carried an on-screen dedication to him.
It feels fitting, somehow, that his final appearance was a voice performance, maintaining that subtle, detached presence even in death.
And the tributes just poured in, cementing his legacy as a true titan of comedy. Jon Stewart called him, without hesitation, the funniest person he knew.
David Letterman, the man who recognized his genius 3 decades earlier, he reiterated his belief. Norm was the best in every important way.
Conan O'Brien mourned him by saying Norm had the most unique comedic voice I have ever encountered. I will never laugh that hard again. just devastating.
The respect really transcended his immediate peer group, too. Dave Chappelle dedicated two of his subsequent Netflix specials, The Closer and The Dreamer, to McDonald's memory. He credited Norm with fundamentally making him fall in love with comedy again.
Wow.
And this influence was felt globally. Lorne Michaels and John Oliver dedicated Emmy victories to him. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau publicly called him a comedic genius. He was recognized not just as a comedian, but as a really significant cultural figure.
So what does this all mean for us, the audience, looking back? We've looked at the career of a comedian who cultivated this anarchic, non-audience-pleasing style, defined by relentless deadpan delivery and this philosophical rigor.
Mm-hmm.
Yet simultaneously, he was intensely private, literary, a fierce loyalist to his friends, and devoutly Christian. So many contradictions.
His career was really a masterful balancing act, wasn't it? Between public chaos and absolute personal control, he built his fame on saying the quiet, difficult parts out loud.
While meticulously shielding the most challenging truth of his own life, that 8-year battle with cancer, from the public eye entirely.
Yeah.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener. His death spurred the release of Nothing Special, that meticulously prepared, dry run of a set, recorded in total privacy, just in case. Did this final deliberate act to ensure his material survived, to control his own narrative, his public image, and to deny the public access to his personal struggle? Did that perfectly encapsulate the understated, eccentric, and fiercely principled nature of his entire comedic career?
It forces us to ask, you know, whether the greatest truth about Norm Macdonald wasn't just in the jokes themselves, brilliant as they were, but in the unwavering commitment to his own unique truth, protected at all costs. If you haven't yet experienced his genius in its purest form, you really owe it to yourself to revisit his work, especially those wonderfully chaotic talk shows like Norm Macdonald Live.
Dive deep into the archives. You definitely won't regret the exploration. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into the genius of Norm Macdonald.